If people could take their seats, I think we're about ready to begin now. My name is Clark Murdoch. I'm a senior advisor here at CSIS. I have a couple of thanks, first of all. Marin Lead, also a senior advisor here, has been organizing these military strategy forums this year and doing a great job. And I also want to thank Rolls-Royce, who is represented by a former associate of mine from the Air Force, Steve Plummer, for sponsoring this event. We've been working with Rolls-Royce on this for many years now. I'm particularly grateful to Marin for asking me to do this because I owe the Air Force a great debt of gratitude. I was Les Aspin, when he was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee and functioning well in that capacity. I was his policy guy. And I came over with Les at the beginning of the Clinton administration, and let's say he didn't do as well as Secretary of Defense as he did as chairman of the Armed Services Committee. And when policy imploded at that time, I ended up in the Air Force. And I've been grateful to the Air Force for two things for my career. First of all, General Fogelman actually empowered me, gave me a position. I was the Deputy Director for Strategic Planning in the Air Force for about 5 years. And it was a great time. I have very strong, very positive memories about the Air Force, in part because of one very vital experience that told me a lot about the care and feeding of your boss, because I had 5 different directors of strategic planning in 5.5 years, which I think is even a record for turnover for the Air Force during this time. And anybody who had as a boss 1 year Chuck Wald, and then the next year Norty Schwartz, knows that I dealt with a diversity of bosses during that time and learned a great deal. Anyway, it's with great pleasure I introduce the current vice of the Air Force, General Howie Chandler. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon. I'm often asked what it's like to be the vice chief. And so I brought a video today that gives you some idea what it's like in a day of the vice chief. I think we got about a 20-second video if we can run that just quickly. It's a fairly lonely job sometimes. But the obvious moral of the story is even when you think things are going well, you need to check six. What I want to talk about today, if I can go ahead and have my, if we can come down with that and have the first slides, a little bit about what your Air Force does for you. I'm going to breeze through a group of slides, allow us to get to some questions. I know we want to talk a little bit about efficiencies. I'm going to warn you right up front that there's still a lot of sausage making going on with regard to efficiencies, and I can talk in some generalities, but we'll have a hard time talking in specifics. But this is what we do for the nation in terms of global vigilance, 100-plus satellites on orbit, as you know, a myriad of manned and unmanned systems, many, many of those becoming unmanned. The key there is persistent and actionable information that we can give to commanders on the ground. Every day, Ray Johns and the Air Mobility Command launch an Air Mobility Command sortie every 90 seconds. Somewhere on the face of the globe, 365 days a year, day in and day out. We transport injured soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines from the Middle East today to the tune of 76,000 of those to date. Over 7,000 of those were critical care casualties as we did it, and we're able to do that with a 90% survival rate. So a lot of good things happening in Air Mobility Command. They also offload about 600,000 gallons of JP-8 every day, all at different places around the globe. All of that done with tankers that are almost 50 years old. And we can talk a little bit more about that when we talk about acquisition. But a lot of good things going on in that area. And of course, in the area of global power, we were founded as an Air Force in 1947 with our ability to strike targets anywhere on the face of the globe. We feel that's important as we look out toward the future. We maintain a set of systems that allow us to do that in a conventional role. We're also responsible for 2 legs of the triad, as you know, that allow us to strike targets in that arena should deterrence fail. The key, I think, to success and the thing that's being driven home to us as we go through the efficiencies drill that we're doing right now is the fact that we're all part of a joint team as we do it. interdependence on each other, quite honestly, is going to become more and more important. I know Pete Corelli has been here. He probably told you the same thing. And when John Greenert follows me, I'm sure he'll probably say the same thing as well. But it's a joint effort and will continue to be, and probably more so in the future. Next slide, please. These are our five priorities. I lay these out for you. I'm not going to talk about this slide because we're going to skip briefly through each one of those. But you can see the nuclear enterprise, our part of the joint team, taking care of the folks that do the hard work for us every day. We could probably spend my entire time talking about modernization of the air and space inventory, but we're not going to do that. And we'll talk just briefly about acquisition excellence. And I've got a couple of slides I'll tack on to the end about the efficiencies and what we're doing in that area. Next slide. This is the nuclear enterprise. This was a $5 billion enterprise this last year for the United States Air Force. That number will increase in the next budget. I'm confident of that. But we focused on compliance and accountability with the Nuclear Oversight Board chaired by the Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief. We've established a directorate on the air staff that's responsible for policy and guidance in that area as well. We centralized that mission and allowed people to concentrate on it. Frank Klotz at Global Strike Command in the area of operations, and of course, out at Kirtland with the Air Force Nuclear Logistics Center. We've talked a little bit about the resourcing. As I said before, we're investing in the bomber force. We're investing in the ICBM force as well to allow that to do its job on out into the future. And then we're going to work our way through the New START treaty. That's a good treaty in our minds, and we need to do that. We'll maintain a balanced triad. You see the mix of weapons there that we'll use. That will entail probably eliminating some ICBMs and converting some B-52s to the conventional role. Next slide. This is where we are today. Almost 39,000 airmen deployed around the globe. You can read on the chart in terms of active duty, guard, reserve, and Department of the Air Force civilians. In terms of ISR capabilities, and that's been a hot ticket item, as we all know lately, we're up to 45 caps that we're flying in the Middle East today. That's with Predator, Reaper, and Global Hawk. We're shooting for a 50 caps in September of 11 and on out to 65 in September of 13. We fielded the MC-12, which we feel was a success story. That was a fairly short order to get that thing in the field. We're going to plan a buy of 42 aircraft. The majority of those are in the desert today and will remain there for as far as we can see in the future. And, of course, we've made a fairly sizable investment in irregular warfare. In terms of aircraft, we're fielding 16 new gunships for AFSOC, MC-12s as well. The VC-22 is part of that mix. We've increased the manning in our 6th SOS by about 250 in terms of being able to look at how we build partnership capacity, and we're looking at the light mobility aircraft for next year and a light fighter aircraft for the year after that to continue to build partnership capacity for in those nations that perhaps can't afford the kinds of equipment that we fly but still would like to partner with us in the things that they do in their countries. Next slide. I show you this again just to show you where we're at. Across the bottom, you can read the numbers in terms of the total active duty guard and reserve and civilians. Along the right-hand side of the chart is where people are typically deployed to today. The blue block in the upper right-hand corner shows worldwide deployed. That was a number that was on the previous slide. The forward station include those people that are in PACAF and USAFE, the preponderance of them in PACAF, a slightly smaller number in USAFE. The thing we typically forget, though, is the block in the upper left-hand corner, and that's those people, the strategic mobility forces that come and go from the theater and not permanently assigned. The space and missile forces that manage the satellites on orbit that sit in the missile silos, as well as the Homeland Defense Mission, the National C4 ISNR, as well as intelligence. So if you will show me the next build, if you look every day in terms of what we have online supporting combatant commanders, I would tell you it's a fairly sizable force. Next slide. I show audiences this slide because I like to talk about what the ARC, the Guard Reserve, contributes to what we do every day. If you look at the far right-hand side and you look at the number and compare mobilized and volunteers, that tells you a lot of things. First of all, we have over twice the number of guard and reserve people volunteering than we have had to mobilize to do the work we're doing today. That tells me a number of things. One, there's a lot of good Americans out there volunteering to do this job. Secondly, we have a construct called the Air Expeditionary Force construct that allows us to rotate people in a fashion that allows them to be accessible. And then finally, this is the point where I urge you to thank those people that are in support of the Garden Reserve, those particular employers that allow people to do this mission. But this has proven to be a good news story for us for the last 9 years in particular. Next slide, please. I'll just touch briefly on this to show you that it took us almost 12 years to fly our first quarter of a million unmanned hours. Unmanned is a bit of a misnomer, as you might imagine. That's why we call them remotely piloted aircraft, because it takes about 200 people to man one of these caps 24/7 in terms of pilots and maintenance and intel people and analysis to make that happen. But the important part of the slide is that it took us 8 months to fly our last quarter of a million hours. Now, obviously, the number of caps are going up as we do this, but this is, in fact, a growth industry. In fact, a third of what we bought last year in terms of aircraft in the United States Air Force were actually RPAs. Next slide. A lot going on in terms of taking care of our airmen. Many of you know that we were on a glide path to take the United States Air Force down to 316,000 active duty airmen at one point in time. We've leveled that off at 332,000. We need every one of them, I would tell you. That's the good news. The bad news is retention is at the highest point that it's been in the last 16 years, and we've had to use expanded force management in terms of keeping the force at 332,000. And as the year ended this last year, we were about 400 enlisted people short in the Air Force. That's really in the noise level. We haven't had an issue with recruiting and retention, but in an effort to bring the force down, that's where we ended up. But we're about 2,400 officers long as we do that. That's money out of our pocket. We need to live within our budget, and that's why we've employed expanded force management to get to the numbers that Congress has told us to be at. We have about 841 wounded airmen in our Wounded Warrior program. Our contract with them is to take care of them from the time they need us until the time they no longer need us. That program has worked out very well with the young men and women that I've had an opportunity to talk to, and I know some of you have probably had an opportunity to talk to them as well. We've just completed the year of the Air Force family. A number of issues we touched on here, health and wellness for two big reasons. We're an expeditionary Air Force. We need young men and women that can deploy to some rather austere places around the world. They need to be healthy to do that. And secondly, if you look at the long-term health cost of the Department of Defense and the United States Air Force, we would like them to be healthy on into the out years when they retire with us. In terms of airmen and family housing, the big ticket item here has been privatized housing. It's allowed us to provide housing for our enlisted men and women much, much sooner than we would have been able to do that in terms of military construction. That's the good news. Some of these projects have gone better than others, but if you look at from a purely efficiency standpoint, this gets us out of something that, frankly, is not a core competency and has allowed us to hire people to do this, and it's actually working fairly well for us. I've had the opportunity to live in three different privatized houses over the last few years. We anticipate that 90% of our housing will be privatized by the end of this next fiscal year. We have a lot of programs, and we've been blessed, quite honestly, with Congress and the department in terms of how we've been able to take care of our airmen and our families, particularly across the last 9 to 10 years. A myriad of programs. When we looked at these programs in our year of the Air Force family, the effort was not necessarily to increase the programs, but to get our arms around the programs that we have and to make sure that we're actually presenting those programs in a fashion that young Airman Smith and his wife can walk onto any installation and take advantage of. So how we get our arms around the numbers of programs that are out there and the good things that are being done for our folks was the focus of that effort. And then, of course, we continue to look at education, development, employment opportunities, not just for our members, but for our spouses as well. We recruit airmen, but we retain families, is the way we like to look at this, and spouse employment is a big part of that. Next slide, please. This is the modernization slide that I talked to you briefly about. You can look at the air, the space, and the cyber kinds of things that we're looking at. All of those things are important to us. Many of the things that we're replacing them with are Cold War systems. When I was a commander in the Pacific, our tanker fleet averaged about 47 years old. We spent 7 hours of maintenance for every hour of flying time. Now, we send those airplanes back through the depot, and the depot does excellent work in getting them back into shape, but they're not zero-hour airframes when they come out of the depot. And in the end, you end up maintaining an old airplane on the backs of the airmen on the flight line that we're asking to do that. So the Air Force needs a new tanker is the bottom line. We can talk more about the F-35. We feel very comfortable with the Air Force variant of that aircraft. We're ahead on test points. We're ahead on sorties. We really started to make money when we got the first two airplanes to Edwards. And the restructuring of the program, I think, has made it a much more realistic program. We think we're through buying C-17s. We're in the throes of modernizing the C-5Bs. That program is going very well. We're going to look at how we approach combat search and rescue here in the future. And then we've been working long-range strike, that's LRS, and I apologize for the number of acronyms here. We've been working long-range strike for as long as I have been back as the vice chief. We think that will culminate here as we approach the release of the budget, and we'll see where we go in terms of long-range strike. Obviously, AEHF, WGS, GPS, and as well as SBIRS are all slowly coming online. The first variants of the first three are on orbit. We're due to launch the first SBIRS satellite right after the first of the year. We'll continue to work cyber. Along with the equipment, we obviously redid organizations to a degree. We talked about the transfer of the nuclear bombers to the new Global Strike Command as well as the ICBMs. Of note there, we stood up the 24th Air Force as the cyber component to the new sub-unified command, U.S. Cyber Command, and that's going quite well for us. But at the same time, that's taking a fair amount of training as we look at training and education and normalizing a career path in the way of cyber. We've actually taken some of our space courses out of Space Command and put those in Air Education Training Command where they, in fact, do the journeyman training for us. And then most recently, we've set up a track for RPA-specific pilots. That's actually working very well for us. The first group of those people are now flying combat missions. And it's been important to make RPA part of our weapons school. We believe if you don't train it at an RTU and you don't train it in weapons school, then you probably don't train it very well. And that's why we've set that situation up the way it is. Next slide, please. I'm a fighter pilot. This is the obligatory fighter slide as we run through this. It gives you some idea of the fact that the high-end competition is not only fairly good, but the high-end competition is working at getting much better at what they do. We're excited about the performance of the F-22. I will tell you we learned a lot from the F-22 as we put together the F-35 in terms of LO types of capabilities, and particularly in terms of the stability of the software in the F-35, and that's helped us a great deal as we've gotten on with that program. Next slide, please. We'll touch just briefly on acquisition. This has not been an area where we have particularly shined in the Air Force over the last few years, particularly with some of the major programs we've talked about already. And I will tell you, as we're on that glide path to take the Air Force down to about 316,000 airmen, we overshot in this area, so much so that to date we've put 2,000 people back into the acquisition workforce. We think that will help us a great deal. We've gone back to the lines of authority that we used to have in the Air Force Materiel Command. We attempted to organize the product centers around wings, groups, and squadrons. We've gone back to directorates, divisions, and branches. That seems to help in terms of clearing up the lines of authority. And then quite honestly, the requirements generation is on the backs of the operators. If we cannot get requirements generation right, then we don't stand a chance to get the last two bullets on the slide correct in terms of budget discipline and some kind of financial discipline, and then improving our source selection. But this is all important to us, primarily for the things that you see over here on the right-hand side as we move on toward tanker source selection and then continue with the JSF program and all the things that we see there in the out years. Next slide. Okay, let me jump into why efficiencies are important. It's interesting to me, efficiencies, I don't think anybody in the Air Force will argue that we can't be more efficient at what we do. There's a difference between effectiveness in part of our mission and efficiency in the rest of the mission. I think Dr. Hamry captures that quite well. You'll note the date on that slide is 1999. So if I can have the next build, please. That's a quote from the Secretary of Defense today in 2010. And I'll tell you, we're still working at this. But Secretary Gates is very serious about it, and it's something that we've all taken aboard. Now, this is not necessarily new to the Air Force, and if I can have the next slide, please. We started Air Force Smart Operations, AFSO 21, for the 21st century several years ago. It's a continuous improvement process. It's not based on lean and it's not based on Six Sigma. We took the best of both worlds, what we thought fit best for our organization, and put those together. And we approach every problem with the 8-step process, and it's actually pretty simple. And I say every problem. We approach those problems that need to be approached that way with the 8-step process. So this is not new. If I can have the next slide, please. I believe that because of some of the logic that we instill with AFSO 21, we accounted for about 55% of the DOD IDs and DOD ideas in what they call the Innovative New Value and Efficiency and Savings for Tomorrow, INVEST, which is a DOD program. You can see what it does for people, but it's interesting to look at what our airmen have come up with across the board. Eliminating wasteful spending. The whole idea that you have to spend all of your budget at the end of the year, you're not going to get the same amount the next year, is probably one we need to try to work our way away from. And then one of the most novel things, and I think that's probably indicative of the generation of young folks that we're dealing with today, is a DOD Craigslist, where you no longer take things over to DRO for disposal, but you put them on a Craigslist. And any other organization around the department or the Air Force, for that matter, can come and claim what it is that you're trying to get rid of. And then, of course, a lot to do in terms of overhead and what we call management-level headquarters in terms of numbered air forces and redundant inspections. Environmental awareness, obviously, is big on our plates as well, and you'll see a lot of energy investment as we get after, as we attempt to get after the efficiencies that we're being asked to look at in the Air Force today. Next slide. So how do we go about this efficiencies issue? And I'll just give you a glimpse at how we build our POM, and we do that by looking at each one of these portfolios in areas of core functions. And as I talked earlier, the nuclear deterrence operations portfolio was about a $5 billion portfolio last year. Within each one of these portfolios, then, we try to balance the capabilities that we need. So it would only make sense, then, that we go back to these portfolios as we look for efficiencies and try to make that balance between effectiveness with the mission that we're trying to accomplish and the efficiencies that we're being asked to achieve as we do this. So that's the list of areas, frankly, where we'll look. And as I said before, it's the same list of core functions and portfolios that we actually sit down and start to structure our POM build with. Next slide. So let me just leave you with this one get-off-the-stage slide in terms of the fact that we are part of the joint team. I hope I've shown you in the slides that we showed you with the active duty guard and reserve, as well as Department of the Air Force civilians, that the Air Force is all in and we're online every day supporting the combatant commanders. It is important, I think, to remember as we do this that the high-end competition is good and they're working to get better, but at the same time, we need to make those adaptations and balance what we need to do to fight today's fight to get ready for tomorrow. We're committed to our Air Force airmen, and in the end, I will tell you that we're going to survive based on how well we do in the efficiencies drill. I think you probably all heard that we need about 2 to 3% a year in terms of top-line growth to be able to maintain the force that we have online today. We're probably, and I say probably because I don't think anything is certain, going to see in the area of about a 1% growth, which in fact, based on personnel cost and other things, could be negative growth when you get right down to it. So if we in fact are going to maintain the force structure we have today, then we need to get after efficiencies to the tune of about 2 to 3% a year. Next slide. This is my last slide. If I may, I'd be more than happy to open the floor to see if we have any questions.
I'm sure that we have many questions. I want to apologize. I neglected to make a couple of announcements at the outset. If I don't make them now, Marn will take out my other shoulder. November 1st is going to be next Monday. There will be two presentations, one from the Navy, essentially covering the same ground that the General does there, from Admiral Brennard at 8:30 in the morning in this room here. We talk about the Navy's approach to efficiencies. And in the afternoon at the St. Regis Hotel, beginning at 3 o'clock, General Sir Nicholas Houghton from the UK Ministry of Defense, the vice there, will come and talk about what it's like to get a 15% cut across the board, which they've just done as part of their Ministry of Defense. So, first question, please. Right there. And again, appreciate people identifying themselves.
Megan Scully with National Journal. Wanted to ask you about the ICBM incident in Wyoming on Saturday and see what effect you think that could have on the START negotiations currently going on in the Hill.
Yeah, let me just address that right up front and say that most of what I have read, quite honestly, tracks with what we know in terms of the incident itself. But there's a couple things that I would add. First, the young men and women that were faced with what was a fairly difficult problem to troubleshoot and solve, in my opinion, did a very, very good job to get the squadron back online in less than an hour. The other thing that I would emphasize would be the fact that the safety and surety of the weapon system was never in doubt as this was accomplished. I think that's all good. Now, there are things we need to work on. There's no doubt about that, and we've been asked by the Secretary to do that, and we will. How this will tie directly to the START negotiations, frankly, it would be very difficult for me to speculate, and I'm going to let the policy folks stick to that one, and we'll see where that goes. In my opinion, it should have really no impact, but again, that's my personal opinion. We'll let the policy folks sort that out.
I'm Harlan Ullman. Thank you very much, General. I want to ask you this sort of red team question. You're familiar with the analysis of the Defense Business Board, which argues that you're understating the problem by a huge amount.
Right.
It's politically obvious why the administration and the department secretary would say, let's look for efficiencies if we can get 2% here, 2% there. But let's assume that you're a third either under budgeted or over programmed, and I'm not talking about you, but the department in general. And that cuts are going to come. What are you doing, not just you, but the other services, the other vice chiefs, in terms of red team thinking, that if you're really presented with the issue of maybe a third cutback overall over a couple of years, how do you take this on? Because it's not going to be on the margins. And as you well know, the Department of Defense, for better or for worse, has been forced to take on a lot of so-called non-military tasks because the rest of the government has not been had the capacity or the capability to do that. How would you respond if you were really going to be doing a red team, zero-based budgeting approach where you really had to do whatever you did but with, say, a third fewer resources over the next 10 years?
Well, you know, we're trying in this particular – let me just emphasize this isn't a budget cut.
I appreciate that.
And I think we all understand that. But, you know, your point is well taken. This is an effort to preserve force structure and to preserve people, read capabilities. So if, in fact, we're faced with not being able to preserve those capabilities, there's only really one answer, and that is that there will be some missions that we will not be able to accomplish. And that will be an issue for the department to prioritize and decide what we need to do. Today, we're asked to be a full-spectrum picket, Army, Air Force, Navy. That's not inappropriate, quite honestly. But should something happen, as you describe, then we would have to take a hard look in terms of capabilities at what we would be able to accomplish. We'll leave that to the President and to the Congress and to the Secretary to see where they want us to go. But your point about red teaming is exactly right, and we have people that spend their time looking at these portfolios to determine what the most important capabilities are and how we can preserve those. I know Pete Corelli talked a lot about some of the scrubs that he's done in some various areas. Munitions is the one that he and I have talked about the most. I would like to tell you that we do that in those portfolios as part of our POM process automatically. I mean, that happens, and we prioritize there. So that would be the foundational way to start in terms of red teaming. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. That's your job.
Such as it is.
Hi, Jennifer Rizzo at CNN. I just wanted to go back to the incident over the weekend with the loss of communication to the missiles. Does it signal a degraded nuclear arsenal?
No. Now, I will tell you that we're dealing in many cases with a weapon system that was designed and built in the 60s. I would also tell you that there's some goodness in the simplicity with the way that system is built and with the robustness with which it is built and with the redundancies and all the other kinds of things that you're familiar with. But I don't think it signals of degradation. Now, having said that, I will tell you that we're going to take a very hard look at command and control and what we need to do in terms of funding nuclear command and control. As I said, it was a $5 billion portfolio last year. I fully expect that to be a larger portfolio this year. But this particular incident will cause us to go back and look at some of the command and control issues. I wouldn't put it in the category, though, of an overall degradation.
Okay, Dan Els from the Congressional Research Service. I've read reports of your colleague, the Chief of Staff, making some remarks on efficiencies that mentioned that perhaps there's a necessity to close more military installations. And to the best of your knowledge, was the general speaking for himself? Was he speaking on behalf of the Air Force, or do you think he might be sort of the front man for the Secretary of Defense on that issue?
Well, I General Swartz is his own man. Let me just start with that. In the scenario that we're in today, and in the scenario that was described by this gentleman earlier, I would tell you that we can't afford to put anything off the table. We'll take a look at everything as we look at efficiencies. I don't know any other way to say that. Some of those issues are easier to deal with than others. We understand that. And again, we'll have to look at where we can get the kinds of efficiencies we need, frankly, in the time frame that we need them. That's going to be part of this equation as we do it, too. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Right there.
Colin Clark, DoD Buzz. Sir, it's a bit difficult to figure out exactly, and I know you're not going to tell us exactly what happened, but if they lost the ability to communicate and they didn't lose the ability to launch, there seems to be a disconnect there. I mean, either you actually have the ability to command and control the missiles or you don't. Did we?
Well, let me just say it this way, and I've seen a lot of things that have been said about the topic that you're talking about, and I guess I just need to be as straightforward as I can be. The vice chief doesn't talk about the readiness of nuclear forces. I mean, that's about the best way I can put it. And frankly, our airmen should not be talking about the readiness of nuclear forces.
All right.
Hi, General. Maren Lead, CSIS. You mentioned at the outset an expectation that there would be increased interdependence between the services going forward, and you alluded to that collaboration with the Army on the munitions piece. Can you say a little bit about areas where you think those interdependencies might increase potentially, and also whether or not that is something that should be left to the services to work out, or whether there's an increased role in for OSE in that framework, or how you see that working?
Yeah, I would tell you a lot of these things come to the front in the JROC. Pete Corelli has talked a lot about munitions. Without talking a lot of details about some of the things we've talked about, he has a portfolio of precision-guided munitions. So does the Air Force. Why is it we don't necessarily measure across the services in terms of quantities or types of systems? And he and I have touched on that just briefly. I will tell you that's not anything that we've cooked or have necessarily schemed on. But one thing that we have worked closely on is the use of the C-27 in terms of direct support. And I think that's a pretty fertile area where we have made some progress in terms of interdependence. If you look at air-sea battle with the Navy, for example, we're looking for the same types of opportunities there. I would tell you I think that's better left to the services, at least to begin with. And then if there is something that's going to impact us all the way across the department or something of a higher order, then perhaps that's an OSD issue to work with as well. But it's interesting to watch how things come together in the JROC. Yeah, I mean, say whatever you want about the JSIDS process. I mean, we all know it's a little cumbersome. But there are some good things that happen in terms of making sure we don't duplicate efforts and being able to bring things together in the JROC itself.
Question
Storm Street with BAE Systems. You talked about having to bring on about 2,000 additional acquisition workforce after going too far in the other direction. Are you where you want to be? Are you still looking for more? And where's the budget come from if you still are understaffed in that area?
No, that's exactly right. We have the first 2,000 pretty much on board. I would also tell you we're hiring in the depots in an effort to get at some of our weapon system support areas also. As weapon systems get older, many times they require more maintenance. We keep our depots busy as we do that. As we go through the efficiencies process, we're asking the same question. Where do we stop in terms of continuing to flesh out manning in Air Force Materiel Command, and particularly in the acquisition world itself? To answer your question directly, we're not exactly sure, and it depends, which isn't a very direct answer, I realize. But we continue to look at what we need in the way of not only acquisition specialist, but also workforce itself in the depots.
Question right there.
General Bill Sweetman from Defense Technology International. You talked about managing the affordability of the Joint Strike Fighter program. You talked about it as perhaps lessons learned, and the restructuring having made it more realistic. Do you envisage any further restructuring of the program, in view of the fact that while the F-35A seems to be doing okay, the F-35B program has been under some more pressure? I mean, are there ways of perhaps isolating the affordability and schedule of the 35A from other aspects of the program, and do you expect changes in that area?
This is not a very good answer, and I apologize, but I think right now it's a little too early to tell, and I think you're alluding to perhaps the UK's decision in their defense review. It's a little early for us to tell. I've talked just briefly with my Marine Corps counterpart on this topic, and we're still working through how we think that may impact the actual VSTOL variant of the aircraft.
Bill Courtney, CSE. A number of tools for efficiency don't seem to be employed as much as they could. For example, the insourcing program, which has been mandated not just in DOD but across the federal government, a lot of experts say that's actually not going to save money but cost more. And indeed, Secretary Gates recently publicly admitted that expected savings from insourcing had not occurred. Competitive sourcing, the A-76 process, has been one which study after study has shown to be something that increases efficiency and productivity and saves money. Even when the government team wins, which I think it does most of the time, the competition process itself has resulted in efficiency. But because of objections from labor unions and others, the competitive sourcing process does not seem to be front and center in the DOD efficiency drill. In the commercial sector, managed services, purchasing managed services rather than purchasing things, is often a cost-effective solution. And that could range from purchasing IT services, training simulation services, in the Air Force context, even tanker services, which the Royal Air Force, I think, uses, for example, in the U.S. Navy for training purposes. Insourcing, competitive sourcing, managed services, these tools seem to be either not being used, or in the case of insourcing, misapplied. This seems like an efficiency effort that has at least one hand tied behind the back. Is that true?
Well, you can characterize it a number of different ways, and I would approach it this way. There are a number of things that should be inherently military in nature that we feel need to be done by government employees. That's been one of the things that I think has helped us with the insourcing. Won't argue the fact that you're going to pay some long-term costs for doing that, and I think that's what the Secretary was saying when he made his statement, although I haven't read his statement. I would tell you that it's very, very difficult sometimes to do exactly as you described. We have a number of people that help us in terms of how we approach different problems. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about commercial industry being a little more free, I think, to use some of those tools. But we're not hesitant to try to make a run at these things, but I think we also need to be realistic as to what's going to work for us. That doesn't help you very much. Your point's taken in terms of efficiencies. But we also have an element of what we do that relies on effectiveness that's probably not going to be as efficient as it otherwise would be. The key for us is to get at those things where we can be efficient and then apply the tools that we think are realistically applicable. In other words, what's going to work for us, what's in the terms of the, or what's in the realm of the possible. We talked a little bit here about installation, closing, and infrastructure. I mean, that was sort of the crux of the question here. We have to be realistic about what we can and can't do. On the timelines that we're being asked to do this, frankly, given the urgency of the problem, not a very good answer. I understand that. But we're not hesitant to try to approach something when we think it's realistic. Does that make sense?
I would actually like to follow up on that question, the prerogative of the chair. When I was in the Air Force, I think we did at least two different, we didn't call it efficiency drills, we called them disinvestment drills. And you would try to make a calculation of the political difficulty of accomplishing something and the costs to be saved by accomplishing it. And there's really two dimensions of it. One is having very senior people within an organization make a political decision, yes, I'm willing to stop doing this, some resistance there. And there's also the congressional aspect of it. One of the things that's very marked, I was talking to a three-star several years ago, a three-star in the UK, about how they did. And he was describing the jointness and the Defense Procurement Agency and this. And he says, but, you know, none of this applies to you. I don't know how you get anything done. You have a Congress. And you've got those two political elements. And as you go through this efficiency, you mention realism. How much does political realism enter into that calculation?
Well, I think it's a big factor in what we do. Not only in efficiencies, but in a lot of other areas. So your point's taken there, too.
Okay. Question right there.
Thank you. David Small from the Reserve Officers Association. General, with the efficiencies that the C5M has proven recently, and the admission by the service that you still need the A models in the service to fulfill your mobility requirements, why is the service not looking at modernizing and ripping the A models?
Yeah, I don't think we've ruled that out completely, but I'll be honest with you, it's going to be a matter of dollars and whether or not we could afford it, which is where we started from in the beginning, quite honestly. But you're exactly right. We're extremely pleased with the M model, extremely pleased. But it comes down to a matter of dollars and cents. If we can make it work, there's a potential we could look at that. Heavy lift is always something that we're interested in. And it also goes back to the right mix and how we are going to be able to take the dollars we have and buy the capabilities that we need. The mobility portfolio, with the exception of the tanker, is probably in the best shape I've seen it in my entire Air Force career, particularly, as you mentioned, with the M upgrades.
Harlan, we'll give you the last question.
General, I want to circle back to my red team from a different perspective, if I could. The Secretary has said he's going to do away with Joint Forces Command, or the headquarters, as well as the Business Transformation Agency. Joint Forces Command obviously was in place to look at jointness and experimentation. BTA was supposed to help do all these efficiencies, and in some ways they did, certainly with their warfighter requirements. What do you see as the psychological impact, if any, of the dissolution of these two organizations? And how is the Air Force going to make up for their absence, or is it really no big deal?
Well, I think this was a logical conclusion when you look at the drill that we're going through right now. We in the Air Force are going to look at overhead and flattening organizations, just like the SECDEF did in terms of JFCOM. This will revolve on how well the rest of the organizations will be able to put together the pieces that had congregated in Norfolk. All those pieces came from somewhere when they went there. How well are we going to be able to put them back? The thing that comes to mind for me is how we manage the global force. For example, JFCOM was a very good arbiter, if you will, between the services as we did that. So can the joint staff do that becomes the question. But I guess I would just end by saying that in each one of these efficiencies that we're looking at and in the areas that we're delving into, both the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Air Force have been very concerned about the unintended consequences. So just, you know, that is one of those additional realities, I think I would add, that we need to pay attention to as we do this. And the closure of JFCOM is going to make us have to look at some unintended consequences of what we're doing.
I would like to everybody to join me in thanking General Chandler for coming here for a very stimulating presentation. Thank you.